From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm John Donvan, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The Devil in the Details, the report on what some call torture by the CIA. Senator Dianne Feinstein.
Releasing this report is an important step to restore our values and show the world that we are, in fact, a just and lawful society.
The Deep South loses its last Democratic senator and gets Republican Bill Cassidy in her place.
This victory happened because people in Louisiana voted for a government which serves us but does not tell us what to do.
The Pineapple Express storms in and blows out the lights in San Francisco.
Chaos this morning on the streets of San Francisco. Transformer explosion leading to widespread power outages.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Michael Hirsch of Politico, Kristen Welker of NBC News, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What is your reaction to the report on the CIA? And what's your top story this week? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Michael Hirsch. He is national editor for Politico magazine. Michael Hirsch, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
And also from Washington, Kristen Welker. She is White House correspondent for NBC News. Kristen Welker. Welker, back to Welker. I'm getting stuck on Welker and welcome, but come on back on the show, Kristen.
It's a tongue twister. John, hi. Thanks for having me back. Appreciate it.
And also from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, John, Michael, and Kristen.
So, two big stories roiling Washington this week. We're going to get to both of them, but first let's start with the aftermath of the Senate Intelligence Select Committee's report on the CIA and what everybody but the report is calling torture, although the CIA also denying torture was involved. In the last couple of days, we've been hearing a strong pushback from the CIA Director John Brennan criticizing the investigation yesterday. He called it flawed. He called it partisan. But he did acknowledge there were times when the CIA went out of bounds.
I certainly agree that there were times when CIA officers exceeded the policy guidance that was given and the authorized techniques that were approved and determined to be lawful. They went outside of the bounds in terms of their actions as part of that interrogation process. They were harsh. As I said, in some instances, I consider them abhorrent.
So, Kristen Welker, not hearing any sort of mea culpa, institutional mea culpa on this one from the CIA, aside from Director Brennan saying that he finds some of the reports abhorrent, but he says that's not the big picture?
That's right. And one of the things that was so striking about this week was that you saw this big gap between Director Brennan and President Obama. And White House officials will say that Brennan is one of President Obama's closest advisors. So it raised some questions about, well, how are they going to work together moving forward on some of these large issues like fighting ISIS, for example? You did hear him soften some of his language, though. He acknowledged the CIA was not prepared. They were in uncharted territory. And of course, he cast all of that in the shadow of 9/11. But you're right. There still was this gap in the language that we heard from Director Brennan, who essentially defended some of those actions, saying that, look, we were in uncharted territory and these times were unique and we weren't exactly prepared for them.
Jack Beatty, I mean, even to see the CIA director holding a press conference, I believe this is to some degree unprecedented that they're so publicly defending themselves.
Well, they've got a lot to defend. You know, if the CIA didn't exist, America's enemies really would have to invent it. Al-Qaeda could have written the menu of torture detailed in the Senate report. They'll recruit off it for decades. You know, at the end of the Cold War, Senator Moynihan surveyed the record of CIA assassinations, CIA-sponsored coups against democratic governments and the like. And he went on to detail the opportunity costs of this thuggery, the CIA's failure to predict the Tet Offensive, the Iranian Revolution, Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, Soviet Union's collapse. And you know, today we see the same pattern. While the CIA was becoming a paramilitary organization, its agents administering rectal rehydration and calling down drone strikes on wedding parties and Afghanistan, he was giving terrible intel. Thus, the CIA was catastrophically wrong about WMD in Iraq, wrong about a connection between Saddam and bin Laden, wrong about the Palestinian election of 2006 that brought Hamas to power. It failed to predict the Arab Spring. It focused on the wrong terrorists in Benghazi. And, of course, its stovepipe intel that might have prevented 9/11. You know, given this history of bad deeds and worse judgments, perhaps the motto on the wall at Langley, "And you shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free," should be replaced with this line from W.H. Auden: "Intellectual disgrace stares from every human face."
Well, but Michael Hirsch, we're hearing Dick Cheney, vice president at the time, defending what was done and also castigating this report sort of on the grounds of the other guys being the bad guys and being the thugs. He was on Fox News on Wednesday called the report a piece of crap and deeply flawed, and he defended all of the techniques outlined in the report.
Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who's the mastermind of 9/11, who has killed 3,000 Americans, taken down the World Trade Center, hit the Pentagon, would have taken out the White House or the Capitol building if, in fact, it hadn't been for the passengers on United 93. He is in our possession. We know he's the architect. And what are we supposed to do? Kiss him on both cheeks and say, "Please, please, tell us what you know." Of course not.
Michael Hirsch, is that point of view getting traction? I mean, certainly there are a lot of people, I think, who would take, just their guts would give them the same sort of response.
Well, it's no surprise to hear that from Cheney, given that he authorized, along with Bush, a lot of these programs and techniques. And I think that's one of the big disappointments of the Senate report, is that it kind of assigns responsibility at the CIA level without acknowledging what everyone who's a student of Washington and in the intelligence national security apparatus knows. The CIA is the president's agency. Mm-hmm. The CIA does what the president wants, and indeed the president himself, President Bush, in his own memoir, acknowledges that he authorized the waterboarding of Abu Zubaydah in 2002, which of course set a lot of these other interrogations into motion. But, you know, I think that Cheney represents the extreme view. And one of the disappointments one hears from people more in the middle is that this was a rather partisan report. It came to conclusions about the efficacy of techniques that perhaps we really do not know. And that's setting aside whether the techniques are moral or right. Most people would agree, and indeed President Obama in 2000, as soon as he came into office, deauthorized the use of waterboarding completely. I think the argument has gotten off on the wrong track to a certain extent. Forget about whether any of these techniques ever bore out any decent intelligence. That's really not what was at issue here. What was at issue here is whether Americans in America ought to be conducting these kinds of interrogations. And, you know, what the defenders of these techniques say is, look, we're taking this out of context. This was a historical moment after 9/11, a nation in fear, a nation angry, a handful of people like Abu Zubaydah and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed we knew were connected with 9/11 who are subjected to these techniques. And we have to, you know, put that in the context of the times.
Kristen Welker, no sense that anybody's going to pay a price for what happened. I'm talking in terms of people who were involved in using these techniques or their leadership at the time. I mean, the Justice Department has looked at this and said, not going anywhere. I know human rights groups around the country are unhappy with that, but there's still no sense that that's going to change.
That's absolutely right. And that's raised some very complicated, tough questions for the White House. The Justice Department has been very clear they're not going to reopen this investigation. Some people want President Obama to call on them to do so. And I've been talking to some folks here who say, look, the president's not going to do that. There's really no precedent for a president calling on the Justice Department to open an investigation. But it raises this question about moral authority, which we have talked so much about this week. You've heard President Obama saying that part of releasing this report is aimed at restoring the moral authority of the United States. Well, the question then becomes, can you actually do that if there are no prosecutions? If a law was broken and no one's prosecuted, or at least if the investigation is not reopened, can that moral authority be restored? Other critics raising the question of drones. Do we have a high ground on moral authority when the drone program has expanded under this president and could potentially expand under future presidents? So those are some of the tough questions, but you're absolutely right. At this point, no indication that there's going to be any real fallout from this report.
Although, Jack Beattie, we are hearing Mark Udall, Democratic senator outgoing from Colorado, referring now to the CIA as a rogue agency, and he called for Director John Brennan's resignation.
The CIA has lied to its overseers and the public, destroyed and tried to hold back evidence, spied on the Senate, made false charges against our staff, and lied about torture and the results of torture. And no one has been held to account.
So how extraordinary is that, Jack Beatty?
It is extraordinary. And, you know, it was a political decision made by the president and his very political attorney general early in his administration. And a lawyer for the Senate committee summed up really what went on. The Justice Department's investigation, he said, made it difficult for a Senate committee to conduct interviews with people who did these procedures. So check there. The DOJ objects to disclosing any details. So checkmate there. That leaves the CIA free to complain about lack of interviews with perpetrators. Pretty neat. That's what you call a cover-up, a machine for a cover-up, which this administration has now done.
You think it's highly, highly unlikely to happen in that case. It's blowing off some steam and some rhetoric, but Brennan's job is safe.
Undoubtedly, he's a partisan of the president's,
right.
But of course, the question of accountability, we see in the paper already that there may be that some of these people mentioned in the report and people who are in the CIA then have to be wary about where they go, because there are courts of, you know, this is a crime of universal jurisdiction, torture, and they could well face criminal penalties, or at least prosecution.
This is On Point. I'm John Donvan in for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking about a big week in the news. You can join this conversation. What do you make of the Rolling Stone story and the rape accusation that, to some degree, appears to be unraveling? Excuse me, the failed Navy SEAL rescue of Luke Somers. We're talking with Michael Hirsch of Politico magazine, Kristen Welker of NBC News, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. And we're also talking with you. We have a number of you already wanting to jump in on the conversation. So let's bring in Tim from Liberty, Kentucky. Tim, you're on point. What's on your mind?
Good day, sir, and thank you for having me. I'll try to make this as fast as I can. I mean, I don't see how anybody can possibly doubt anything that's being said about the CIA. I mean, from being literally caught red-handed in the 1980s, shipping tons and tons and tons of cocaine into this country when they were working actively in Central and South America. Now we have a heroin glut in this country, a major epidemic, and where is the CIA spending most of their time? Afghanistan. Heroin capital of the world. Well, isn't that an amazing coincidence?
Well,
you know what? The thing about it is the war that they say they're having, a war on terror. They're not having a war on terror. They're creating terrorists.
Tim, thanks very much for your call. I hear your passion is strong. I want to bring in Rob from Newburyport, Massachusetts. Rob, thanks for joining us on Point.
Hi, John. I'm calling about the torture topic. And John McCain, you know, I didn't even vote for the guy, but I respect his experience and seems like he's the Rodney Dangerfield of our government. Nobody listens to him. He's the one guy who's actually been tortured, knows it doesn't work. He has access to this information, yet you know, his leadership, his party, and the government overall doesn't seem to respect or look for his guidance. What do people think about that?
Interesting point, Rob, because he's definitely somebody who has been critical of what the CIA has been accused of doing. At the same time, here's what he's been saying about it this week.
I know that victims of torture will offer intentionally misleading information if they think their captors will believe it. I know they will say whatever they think their torturers want them to say if they believe it will stop their suffering.
So, Kristen Welker, there we have a senator who has an unusual, unique, distinct, and relevant perspective on the topic. So where does McCain come out on this? And as Rob was asking, is he being listened to?
I think he is being listened to. And in fact, I've had a pretty robust discussion with a number of members of Congress who are on the other side who say, look, we do think there's actionable intelligence that comes from this, particularly with Peter King of New York. He's sort of on the other side of McCain. And he makes it very clear he has so much respect for Senator John McCain. I do think he makes people listen. And we're talking about what is the main point here. Is it these practices were torture? I think McCain raises this other argument, which is that we do need to consider whether or not these torture tactics are effective. And of course, you heard the CIA director suggest that it is believed there was some actionable intelligence that came from some of these tactics. But President Obama, interestingly, won't weigh in on that, making the point that that's not the key issue here. Senator John McCain is basically saying, no, we do need to debate that issue as well. People need to know, because I've experienced it, that you don't get accurate information. And he's sort of raising that point and saying, look, this is one of the key points that needs to be determined.
So his words are counting. Let's bring in Ade from Ann Arbor, Michigan. Ade, welcome to On Point. What's on your mind?
Hi, John. Thanks for taking my call. I want us to interrogate the use of language, both by the apologists of torture and by members of the media. The director of the CIA, speaking yesterday, used the term EITs as an acronym for enhanced interrogation techniques, rather than simply saying torture. The report from the Senate describes the practice of quote-unquote rectal feeding, which sounds an awful lot like a sexual violation. And so what is the complicity of the media in making the general public more accepting of torture simply by adopting the language?
That's a very interesting question, Ade, and it's one that I know that all news organizations are wrestling with, what language to use. Michael Hirsch, you're writing about this stuff every day at Politico. How is the media figuring out what to call these things?
I think for the most part, the mainstream media, quoting President Obama himself, who called waterboarding torture, uses the appropriate words. Enhanced interrogation techniques, or EITs, the term used by John Brennan in his news conference yesterday, those terms are often put in quotes, obviously conveying the irony that, you know, this is a euphemism. So I think for the most part, there has been a frank discussion of this. And let's bear in mind, you know, there's a lot of demonization of the CIA going on here. Let's bear in mind that this was a program that the CIA had forced upon it by the George W. Bush administration, by Vice President Cheney. And that is the way the CIA works. It works in accord with what the White House wants. As we know from the report itself, many CIA operatives, people involved with the program, were not happy about some of these techniques, particularly as they went completely overboard with some techniques that even Cheney said the other day he didn't know were being used, like, for example, rectal hydration. So I think, you know, we need a little bit of balance to this discussion. The CIA is not really, you know, it's not a rogue agency.
But Michael, I think what I hear Ade saying is, listen, let's take waterboarding for an example. Should waterboarding just be called torture by the media? Waterboarding, the torture technique?
I think for the most part, it has been regarded that way. Mm-hmm. Several years ago, famously, the late Christopher Hitchens had himself waterboarded and wrote a piece in the New Republic saying, this is torture. I don't think anyone disagreed. From my observations, as I said, when we use these terms, enhanced interrogation techniques, we often put them in quotes.
Jack Beatty, our other big story out of Washington today, for somebody, for example, who just landed from a journey to Mars and just gets back, explain what's going on and use the word omnibus in the sentence.
If not the word crumnibus.
Yes.
The House, in its wisdom, passed a $1.2 or $3 trillion spending bill, taking us into through 2015, a major achievement. But it included some policy writers, and those writers really exposed the systemic corruption of American politics. No one defended them. They were inserted without debate, and Citibank supplied much of the language of one of them, a Wall Street giveaway. One writer weakens regulations of the big banks, while the other allows the big bankers to contribute more money to the Solons who just gave them this gift. A donor now limited to $97,000 could give $770,000, a couple as much as $3.1 million to party committees. J.P. Morgan Simon joined with President Obama to call Democrats to lobby to support the bill. The big banks run the Senate, Dick Durbin said a few years ago. They now run the House and the White House and American politics. And only a small band of liberals and conservatives in the Senate, David Vitter of Louisiana, Sherrod Brown of Ohio, and Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts, only this small band has the possibility, the chance, to at least filibuster this giveaway to
Wall
Street.
Let's hear Elizabeth Warren on this.
The House of Representatives is about to show us the worst of government for the rich and powerful. The House is about to vote on a budget deal, a deal negotiated behind closed doors that slips in a provision that would let derivatives traders on Wall Street gamble with taxpayer money and get bailed out by the government when their risky bets threaten to blow up our financial system.
Kristen Welker, again, for our person just coming back from Mars. Why would Jack Beatty be talking about this as sort of the epitome of what's wrong with Washington?
Well, I think that one of the things that people were so critical of was this point that Jack made, which is that these riders were put in overnight. I mean, it seemed as though everything was smooth sailing, and then you have these riders that just are abhorrent to the Democratic base that were put in, essentially scaling back Dodd-Frank, McCain-Feingold, these two things that President Obama had fought for. And yet you have the White House signing on and saying, look, this is compromise. I think what was so interesting about this moment, in addition to all of that, is that it sort of underscored the fact that you have this strong populist arm of the Democratic Party. It also was sort of this stark contrast. Usually it's the Republicans that have been divided, at least over the past several years. Now it's the Democrats. And of course, that's in part because they just lost Congress. And I think ultimately the calculation was made, look, it's only going to get worse for Democrats because, of course, next year Republicans take over. So that's why you had that strong arming from the White House, from Harry Reid trying to get Nancy Pelosi to essentially give in. By the way, it also, I think, highlights the fact that the people who are making this deal, the deal makers at the White House and in the Senate, seem to not have included Nancy Pelosi because she was infuriated and was prepared to go to the mat over this and did to some extent.
And yet we hear a little bit of joy about this all from Majority Whip Steve Scalise. He's a Louisiana Republican. And he's saying it actually sets up an opportunity for Republicans to challenge the president in the next Congress.
Tonight we set the stage for a battle with the president on his illegal actions on immigration when we have a Republican Senate in just 4 weeks.
So what's he talking about, Michael Hirsch?
Well, clearly the conservative right is, you know, was outraged by the failure to make any effort to defund either Obamacare or the recent executive actions Obama's taken on immigration, which is a real flashpoint. It was interesting to hear Sean Hannity of Fox News berate John Boehner, calling him a John Gruber, which is interesting, interesting reference. And so you have what's happened here is both the extreme right and now the extreme left are up in arms. And that's why you're going to see a lot of battles over the next year over this. I mean, to go back to what we were just talking about, in some ways, I think Citibank and Jamie Dimon of J.P. Morgan Chase, who pushed through this rider, may come to regret it, because what they did was they handed a gift to Elizabeth Warren and the Democratic left, which, you know, wants to mount its own insurgency, and basically allowed them to nearly defeat this bill. So I think you're going to see a lot of battles in the year ahead.
Let's bring in David from Austin, Texas, to the conversation. David, welcome to On Point, and tell us what's on your mind.
Hi, John. I have a different perspective. I spent 10 years as a financial advisor. I got out in a couple years ago because the general public has no clue to the complexity involved in these financial instruments. This is exactly what Warren Buffett talked about at WMD, these swaps, credit default swaps. That is exactly what brought the system down when AIG had a bunch of bets that weren't really insurance. And for the taxpayer to be the backstop on risk, this just reintroduces moral hazard and codifies it. How can someone not be disillusioned who's actually informed that these political games that are played are actually using the authority of the American economic system as some kind of poker chip?
Thanks, David, and you do sound appalled. Let's bring in Danielle from Woodward, Iowa. Danielle, welcome to On Point.
Hi, John. I, too, am appalled at the results of the last election, and I'm also appalled at the banking crisis that is looming based on what the Republicans are trying to do again. I'd like to ask all of your commentators if they have ever considered what I'd like to call liberal fatigue. It is politically incorrect to talk about it, but we in the liberal left tend to vote Democratic. We tend to vote against our own best interests. We vote to fund social programs for those who are less fortunate and less economically well off. And in the circles I travel in, I am hearing fatigue in supporting people who vote against their own interests.
Interesting question. Before we take that question to the panel, I also want to point out that that as of now, the Deep South no longer has a Democratic senator. Mary Landrieu of Louisiana lost her runoff election to Republican Bill Cassidy, and she was the last. It's the same in terms of governors and control of legislatures. And this was her concession speech on Saturday night.
Together we have also fought a good fight, and it's not over yet, for health care. Because to have a strong workforce to lift our state and move it forward and to lift our nation forward, we have to have a healthy workforce.
So Kristen Welker, sort of combining the question that Danielle brought up and the reality of what just happened in Louisiana, is there sort of a message of a separation between, permanent separation between North and South and a liberal fatigue? Because there is actual discussion or advice being given to the Democratic Party to stop trying to win over the Deep South and put its eggs in other baskets.
Well, I think and you saw that play out, of course, in the elections and Democrats losing Congress. And I think you're seeing that play out on some of these larger issues. Healthcare is a good example. President Obama still struggling to sell that message to the American public, to convince them that that was the right move. And yet, I think that the counter to that and what some people would say is, look, part of the problem is that the Democrats aren't doing a good enough job of talking about the things that they have been successful at, like improving the economy. Of course, everyone acknowledges it's not adding the amount of jobs that ultimately need to be added for it to be incredibly robust, but it's moving in the right direction. Did Democrats, for example, run too far away from President Obama in this last election? So I think that there is something to that you're seeing liberal fatigue, if you want to call it that, or potentially people just distancing themselves to some extent from the president and from some of his more unpopular policies.
Jack Beatty, what do you think on this one?
Well, on the South, I mean, it really fulfills the prophecy that LBJ gave to Bill Moyers when the Civil Rights Bill passed. He said, there goes the South for the Democratic Party for a generation. Well, it took a generation for everything to fall into place for Southern white voters who'd been used to splitting their tickets between the National Party, where they'd vote against Democrats, and the state and Senate and House levels, where they'd vote for their local Democrat. Now they've smoothed that out, and there's consistency in voting. And you have, I think, Landrieu lost 70% of the white vote and got 80%+ of the black vote. There you have it, a black party and a white party. That is the recipe for Southern hegemony in the South.
And does that feel like a static situation? That's the way going forward for a long, long time.
Well, I do think so. People talk about the Democrats' white working class male problem, but scholars will look at this say if you leave out the South, they have a tiny little problem. They've lost 2 or 3, 4 points over the years from, the big years when they got white working class votes in the North, but in the South, by 20, by 30, by more points, they have lost that white working man vote, men and women. And that's a cultural problem. That's a big, big problem. But, Democrats can win elections without the South.
This is On Point. I'm John Donvan in for Tom Ashbrook. In other news this week, Prince William and Kate Middleton are touring the U.S. They took in a basketball game, and Jimmy Fallon noticed.
Last night, they went to a Brooklyn Nets game and actually met up with Jay-Z and Beyonce afterwards. When asked what it was like meeting real royalty, William and Kate were like, amazing. They're amazing. They're really all great in person as well. Yeah, amazing.
And the Golden Globe nominations were announced. Birdman soared to the top with 7 nominations.
Are you at all afraid that people will say you're doing this play to battle the impression that you're a washed-up superstar?
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. That's why 20 years ago I said no to Birdman 4.
Hold the mask off.
Thank you, everybody.
You do pop the mask.
And the stop-motion animated special, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, celebrates 50 years this week, featuring the voice of Burl Ives.
Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer had a very shiny nose, and if you ever saw it, you would even say it glows.
So there is some light in all of this darkness. You can join the conversation. What do you think about Guantanamo prisoners on their way to Uruguay, the Hong Kong protesters forced off the streets? I'm joined by Kristen Welker of NBC News, Michael Hirsch of Politico magazine, and On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Michael Hirsch, this story about Rolling Stone's story about the alleged rape case at University of Virginia unraveling still further. How much worse can this get for the magazine, and also even more broadly for the cause of the credibility of rape victims wanting their stories to be believed, needing their stories to be believed?
I'm not sure that it can get much worse. Basically, the Washington Post has led the way in effectively re-reporting the deeply flawed Rolling Stone story, and the deeper we get into it, the less credible this woman at the heart of it, Jackie, is. There are even questions now about whether she made up an even lesser version of the story that appeared in Rolling Stone. Rolling Stone has already disavowed that, the idea that she was gang raped at this frat house at a party. But even what she apparently told friends who were quoted by the Washington Post is in doubt now. It's been a devastating story for Rolling Stone. It is a devastating indictment of poor journalistic and reporting techniques that were clearly used here, a failure to check out the aspects of Jackie's story, the pitfall of relying on one source in a story of this size. All of this has come home to roost for Rolling Stone, and so there is going to be a reckoning for that magazine. But also, as you suggest, this has had serious impact on the issue of sexual assault and credibility in terms of the victims. And I think that those who are activists, particularly on-campus activists, are very fearful, and with reason, that other stories, other victims that come forward are going to be, doubted beyond what is warranted in terms of, them being seen in the light of this false story.
And Jack and Kristen, you know that the University of Virginia put a temporary close on all of its fraternities when the story was published, using the story as the trigger. You have to wonder, did they at the time have any choice in the matter?
John, I've been doing a fair amount of reporting on this story this week as well. I think they didn't feel as though they had a choice. By the way, that suspension of the fraternities and all Greek life remains in place while the university investigates. There are still people on campus, advocates, who believe that there is some kernel of truth to Jackie's story. I think one of the most damning pieces of evidence was just reported in the latest Washington Post article, which makes the point that her friends doubted the existence of her date even before this alleged night happened. So in other words, she talked about the fact that she had this date, and they started to feel as though she had created this fictional character even before the alleged incident happened. So I think that's one of the devastating facts here. But I just want to underscore the point that was just made, which is that you have victims' rights advocates speaking out and saying, look, regardless of what the truth is with Jackie's story, it is so vitally important that we remember that this remains a crisis on campuses all across this country, that this is a conversation that needs to be ongoing, that we need to continue to create safe spaces for women or for survivors of sexual assault to speak out.
Let's bring in Eric from Griffin, Georgia. Eric, welcome to On Point, and tell us what's on your mind.
Yeah, how you doing, John?
We're good.
I think the question that we should be asking is, how did this happen at Rolling Stone? And the answer is pretty obvious when you start to look at it. Really, men have been pretty much vilified in the media. And now we've reached a point where if any woman makes a rape accusation, well, then it must be true. And this is what happened to Rolling Stone. There are so many of these accusations going on. There is so much fervor about all the campus, the problems at American campuses, the numbers, something like 1 in 5 women or 2 or 3 in 10 women or whatever the number is of women that have been assaulted on campuses. All this is that women have won this PR battle, And it's caused, Rolling Stone to just simply assume, well, if these accusations were made, well, then they must be true. So that's the point that we've reached sort of in the popular media. There's two things going on here. The first thing is women that have accused someone of rape have to go through a terrible process with the rape kit and all that stuff, and they're made to feel very uncomfortable, and a lot of times they don't report it because this process is so problematic. So that's got to be fixed. But I think taking a step further from that, I think there's also sort of a battle of the sexes going on, and we really need to also have a conversation about human sexuality. I think there's a certain facet of the feminist movement who are taking this a step further and are making this about control in the bedroom.
That sounds like, Eric, thank you. That sounds like a topic for a great show down the road. But thank you for jumping in on the University of Virginia story. I also want to bring in Alma from Somerville, Mass. Alma, welcome to On Point. What's your opinion on this?
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm really concerned about this issue because too many people seem to think that memory is a tape recorder or a video recorder. It's not. Memories are complicated, and I think they're even more complicated by a great trauma that happens to someone. The NPR itself did a follow-up story, and I think it was last Sunday, they interviewed a woman who works at UVA. She's a graduate of UVA, and she interviewed this woman, has worked with her, and I think the reason Rolling Stone is backing away is because if you keep asking someone the same story, they don't always remember it the same way, and there are differences, and so they think, well, maybe she made it up. It's very hard for people to say the exact same thing every time, but I think we need to look more into how people remember things and not just think that just because they say a slightly different story that they must have made it up.
All right, Alma, thanks for your call. I want to turn now to the other side of the world. In Hong Kong, police finally went in and did a final push for this two-month occupation in the financial district down there. They went in, tore down tents, arrested a lot of people, and Alex Cho, a student protest leader, vowed that there will be more demonstrations to come.
We will not choose to cooperate with an unauthorized government. We are not selected and voted by the Hong Kong people. We will resist till the last moment.
Michael Hirsch, did the last moment come, or are we a long way away from that?
Well, I think you're a long way away from this. I mean, what's going on here broadly is the very gradual dismantling of the one country, two systems, so-called approach to Hong Kong after it was handed back by Great Britain to China in 1997. And I think that actually a lot of China watchers are a little surprised that the Beijing government has been as lenient as it has. After the protests first began, there was talk of a Tiananmen Square-style crackdown. Beijing, sort of pulling strings behind the scenes, has left it to the Hong Kong administration to slowly dismantle this protest movement and their encampment without really much bloodshed. And you can expect that they will be back. But you can also expect that there's going to be more arrests. There were more than 200 arrests when they demolished this protest camp the other day. But it's going to be a quiet, I think, asphyxiation of this democracy movement as Beijing moves in gradually to take over.
Jack Beatty, on another topic, the word appalling has already come up in this conversation. Appalling to me is the news report, not 100% confirmed, but the rumored news report that ISIS, the group that's been beheading Westerners in Syria and Iraq and beheaded journalist James Foley, are now trying to sell his body, that they are saying they'll take $1 million in return for his body. At the same time, ISIS, there are indications now that perhaps ISIS is beginning to lose a little bit of its momentum. The government in Iraq is saying that that they think they're beginning to win, but they can only do it if the U.S. suddenly supplies them with a great deal more in terms of weaponry and other support. So what are the odds of them getting that support in the current climate?
Well, I think they're going to get some support. They're not going to get troops on the ground, and it may take that to retake these cities. They seem to be, the Iraqis, optimistic about being able to retake the cities even as early as the spring. Our people say no, they need to be trained more than that. So we just don't know. But you know, on James Foley's, on this ghoulish and appalling, as you say, appalling story, people need to face something here. James Foley not only was killed, he was tortured. And let that, people who think the CIA, that's why the military has been against this for years. One U.S. soldier caught, tortured. Essentially, they would be able to say, you torture, we torture. Who ever thought that would happen in the United States?
Well, it's no coincidence, apparently, that they put these hostages in orange jumpsuits. It's an inspiration inspired by what they see at Guantanamo Bay, and it's a little bit of flipping the bird in the direction of the U.S. And on Guantanamo, Michael Hirsch, we have some scaling down in the population there and trips to Uruguay. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, the Obama administration's policy has been to get rid of as many of these prisoners as they can by sending them to foreign prison sites, in this case Uruguay, with six of them, of the 70-odd that remain, also to Yemen. And, you know, let's put some perspective on this. This is the other side of the coin of the CIA torture report issue. This is a bunch of prisoners. Many of them have been there for 12 years or more, including Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the mastermind of 9/11, who were subjected to various forms of torture, including waterboarding, and who therefore, in terms of being tried either by the civilian courts or even by military commissions, which remain very much in co-ed at this point, these cases are in trouble. I mean, U.S. military lawyers say so because of the tainted nature of the evidence against them, which was gotten by these illicit means, by means such as torture. And so we find ourselves in a state of limbo, as do these prisoners, some of whom, a number of whom are probably completely innocent and have been there languishing for more than 10 years. And so I think there's just this policy of let's just get rid of them.
Do we know what happens to these? I think it's six men are being released to Uruguay. What happens to them there? Do they get settled? Do they get passports? How does that work for them?
Well, I mean, you know, they're supposed to remain confined by the local authorities. But I think there's a lot of concern, and particularly in this case in Uruguay, whether this may come back to haunt us.
That they'll be sprung.
Exactly.
Yeah. Dennis is calling in from Omaha. Dennis, welcome to On Point.
Hello. This whole thing with the torture to start the war, like a curveball thing for, but the thing about, I want to compare Guantanamo to the president's executive action in immigration. The president took unilateral action to provide due process for people who aren't getting due process, so he's delaying deportation. But Guantanamo was created specifically by name. Everyone acknowledges that Guantanamo was created to deny due process. And so basically it's a statement. Every time someone defends Guantanamo, they're defending the view that we can't trust our justice system. But that's the whole point. But the only thing that makes us different from communism and from terrorism and all that other stuff is due process of law.
All right, Dennis, thanks for your point. And I want to bring back to Kristen Welker this Guantanamo issue for the president and Michael Hirsch's point that, basically he wants it to go away, but he can't make it go away.
That's right.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I think one of the things that's so interesting, and based on my conversations here, you're going to see more of these releases. And we've sort of seen up a stepped up pace in terms of trying to transfer some of these prisoners in recent weeks. And by the way, that was part of the frustration with outgoing Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel. There was a sense here that he wasn't approving some of these transfers quickly enough. And so that was among a litany of reasons that President Obama decided it was time to have a new defense secretary. This is, of course, something that he vowed to do when he first came into office. It hasn't been completed yet. And so I am told that he's been very forceful in some of these meetings that he wants to see this close by the time he leaves office.
Michael Hirsch, before we finish up, we've mentioned that Time magazine is naming the Ebola fighters as persons of the year. But very briefly, sort of whatever happened to Ebola in the United States? We had an Ebola czar and great debates about immigration restrictions. And where are we now? Where is the Ebola czar?
Well, it seems to have, the Ebola czar is planning on leaving. Ron Klain, a political operative whose appointment as Ebola czar, so-called, really raised some eyebrows because he's obviously not anyone with any kind of medical expertise at all. I think the bottom line is that there's a sense it has been successfully contained, and the cases that we had here in the U.S. have been cured. I mean, that is at least where we are now, but it's still raging out of control in Africa.
Well, that is some good news here, not so good news for Africa. Michael Hirsch, National Political Editor for Politico Magazine, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Kristen Welker, White House correspondent for NBC News. Thanks to you, Kristen.
Thank you.
And On Point News analyst Jack Beattie, as always, thanks, Jack.
Thank you, John.
You can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up on Monday, the CIA on the CIA. After the explosive Senate report, what is the agency's own saying about torture and the way forward? I'm John Donvan, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.